Do you know how often? How long to go around once?
Just every 24
hours. Yeah, 24 hours. Do you know what the diameter of the Earth is? The radius of the Earth?
Are you admitting that?
I know what it is. Astronomers have measured this. Eratosthenes measured the circumference of the Earth in a very clever way. From shadows. It's about 25,000 miles. So if I'm standing on the equator and you're right, forget standing on the equator, at this latitude, if you're right, we are hurtling towards the east at 700 miles an hour, which is crazy. Yeah, exactly. Why isn't there a wind? If I hold this up and let go of it, it ought to go like that. 700 miles an hour.
Acceleration is towards the center.
What?
Acceleration is towards the center.
Whose acceleration? What is it?
Okay, we set up a pendulum.
Oh, come on.
We've got to go to the pendulum. Go for the pendulum.
We've got to have a pendulum. Really long, high mass.
Yeah, that's right. Give it a moment. Give it a shot. Let it go.
Yeah.
And we watch it mark its path on the ground. And over a period of time, it's going to rotate.
Over 24 hours, it will.
You mean the plane of the,
that's right.
the plane of the swing of the pendulum.
Yeah.
This we should do at the equator.
Only under very special circumstances.
Well, it has to be a frictionless.
Oh, a frictionless.
The one that they ran the three millions for the equator is pretty much the equator, closer to the equator.
It'll still turn.
It'll turn in 24 hours. It'll return to its original.
What keeps it going? I've never seen anything.
It's very high mass, so it's got a long period.
And lots of grease.
Oh, yeah.
And a universal joint of 3.
No.
Well, then the hinge is
rotate.
All right, so the plane of rotation, the plane of swing of this pendulum rotate.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Okay, so
if that's really true, if I saw that, then I would have to ask what's bringing it about, right? Here's something's going on. What's causing that? I might posit that it's being caused by the rotation of the sphere of stars. Well, that would be a question. How? That would be a good question. How? But that's an option.
What does the pendulum do?
It's a Foucault pendulum. It's a great long pendulum, and it's swinging. And you see these in science museums. It's a story of science. You don't know what's going on in your own primitive construction.
But
if you've got a string, for all I know it's twisted, and for all I know it's unturning, and so that, who knows? But the idea is, you set a pendulum up, and presumably it's on a nearly frictionless joint, and then it could be dropping sand. It could be the bob could be a great big bucket of sand with a little tiny hole. So it traces a little path of sand. The plane of swing, let's suppose it started out parallel to the blackboard. If you came back in a few hours, it would be like this. Now, either the plane of swing of the pendulum has turned, or the classroom has turned underneath it, as it were.
The one that they have at the Smithsonian, they have a thing of huge diameters.
Right, bomb.
And so it goes around the circle,
knocks them all over.
For
right. So either the room, the building, is turning under this thing, which is the plane is staying in the same plane in absolute space or whatever, and the Earth is turning underneath it. This, if you believe Newton's physics, then this is a fairly good demonstration that the Earth is turning. But it wasn't done until 1852. Or 57 or something, which is 200 years too late for Galileo.
Yeah.
But that's what it is, yeah.
Yeah. So it's surprising it wasn't done earlier, really, because I mean, it's so simple an experiment.
Well, it may not be so simple to get a pendulum that'll do it convincingly.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess if your friction, if you have a little too much friction up there, the force is so slight, it would just tend to stay in the same place.
That's right.
That's a pretty good.
But I don't.
But why would anybody think of doing it? It's not a theory to back it up.
Well, by Newton's time, you do.
I'm just wondering, sort of.
So it is curious, and I, there would be a little project if somebody's very interested in this. Is anybody thinking about that particular phenomenon, which has nobody's ever seen? I mean, for all, as far as I know, nobody saw this until the middle of the 19th century, a little more than 100 years ago. And it's more than 300 years ago that there's this conviction that the Earth is moving. So it's rather late on the scene. And I think the obstacles to having this work out convincingly are technical ones, and they're very tough. So, but even if it worked out, if that's the only problem I've got as an Aristotelian, in my research institute, I'm going to be looking for a causal connection between the rotation of the sphere of stars and the rotation of that plane of swing, because that's what's correlating perfectly. This thing is following the stars around. Don't ask me why. We've discovered a causal influence.
It could be an unexpected pathway that a moving body takes to reach a stable resting point
it's possible. But if somebody singled out and convinced me that, my God, the plane of swing of this thing is really turning, and it's not got to do with wire uncoiling or something else goofy. I mean, engineers are going to have to look at this for months. I'll lay out an if-then. If that plane is really turning, then I'm going to be looking for what's making it turn. And the obvious thing for me to think of is the thing that correlates perfectly with the rotation of the sphere of stars. And if you say it proves the Earth moves, I'll say you better give me more than this to go on. Or
it's a good start.
It's not a good start. It's so crazy an idea.
It proves astrology.
Pardon me?
It proves astrology.
That might happen. There might be some people who say there are causal influences from the heavens, like the moon on the waters of the Earth. And here's another very subtle, as yet undetected, example of that, and a bloody boring one to boot. And it's the most boring kind of thing you could imagine. And what I'd say is, look, before we, you know, how big is your budget? Before we spend zillions of dollars getting this all arranged, what in the world makes you think the Earth moves? I mean, give me a break. What is this worth the trouble? But what? Why? What makes it's?
I'm an aristocrat.
You got nothing else to do. Well, all right.
Which is why they hired a lot of the scientists.
This is better than straining peasants or something. It's probably true.
So we talk from the old
one. Yeah, right. Okay. Well, can anybody give me a slightly less modern?
Yeah, I've got a couple of questions suggested.
Sure. Right.
First of all, how do you explain the changes in the night sky with the seasons?
Easy.
And how do you explain the phases of the world of the moon?
Easy.
Go for it.
Oh, boy. Well, all right. Here's the Earth at rest in the center of the world.
Right.
Okay. There it is. Well, I mean, look. Okay, around it goes, and you can see this for yourself, a whole bunch of things. And they rise in the east, roughly, and set in the west, roughly. And if I stare at these things long enough, I see that it looks like, I'm not saying it is, it looks like bright bits of light, indeed, on the inner surface of a sphere, and I can even see towards the north what would be the imaginary pole of that sphere. There are some stars that never go below the horizon. I only see them when it's dark. But, ouch, oh God, there they are.
You see the Earth just moving an inch of finger.
Yeah, right. Okay, So, but I look at these stars, and they don't change their position with respect to each other at all, as far as I can see. Right, except for the Big Dipper keeps on being the Big Dipper, reliably. Orion keeps on being Orion, reliably. Da, 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 da. There they are, fixed, it looks like. Whatever they are, they don't change their relative positions at all.
Okay. Observing longer, though.
Well, maybe, but people have been observing these and measuring them for a very long time. And so far, no relative displacement notice.
Yes.
What I've got is almost like a kind of enormous big piece of spherical graph paper turning around me, with respect to which I can map stuff. All right, so that's what I'll do. I'll pick a place called, I'll pick a place as a starting point, and you know, I can count out from there, and count up from there, and down, north from there, south from there, east from there, west from there, ding, da, ding, da, ding. I'll say it's 360 degrees around because I like the sexagesimal system and I'm Egyptian. You know, and I can divide all this up. And now I can start dealing with those things that I see do move over the nights compared to these stars. Things I've already named: Mercury, Venus, Sun, Moon, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. So let's take the Sun. Well, just as I see a pole, now this is still imaginary. I mean, I don't really believe there's a sphere, okay? But there are these fixed stars, or fixed bits of light, anyway. All right, so here it is, turning around east to west. And here I am inside it. By the way, here's part of the reason I know the Earth is round. Because as I walk north, the apparent pole of this sphere gets higher and higher in the sky. As I walk south, it gets lower and lower. And if I'm on the equator, there it is on the horizon. What do you mean?
Rounded.
Absolutely. Not only do I know it's round, I can explain why it's round. And I know that in the 5th century BC. This is not liberal, this is common sense. Plus educated wisdom or knowledge.
Why would you say arbitrarily that stars rotate, yet the Earth is...
Well, I haven't said it arbitrarily yet. What I've said is what appears to be. So far I'm just saying what appears to be. Well, I got to deal with the Sun and Moon. It'll take me just a minute. I see this stuff. I know, let's just take the stars, either all that stuff is rising in the east and setting in the west, or, and I'm standing here, or I'm turning west to east and it's at rest, or one of the many combinations of the two. It's moving at half the speed, I'm moving at the other half. Okay? I mean, I know about this business, this is called visual relativity. I'm in a bus station, the guy starts the bus up, and all of a sudden I'm driving into the lobby. But oh no, I'm not, it's the bus next to me backing out. But I've almost, I got adrenaline going all through me. Because I thought, I'm going forward, but it's the bus beside me going back. You've seen that, haven't you? Or you're on a boat, you'll find Buridan quoting this, you're on a boat and all of a sudden you think the dock is sailing away from you. And all of a sudden you realize that it's the boat. But then you stop and say, well, now wait a second. You know, is the shore really sailing away from me? Baloney. I'm moving, not the shore. And later on I'll say, baloney, it's got to be the stars that are moving, not me. But that's because I got reasons to believe that. That is, I'll explain it. Right now we're just talking about what we see. All right, and let's say I can deliver some reasons later, but I have reasons to think the Earth is spherical at rest in the center of the world, and these stars really are going around it.
All right, but I want to map the sun and moon and stuff like that compared to them. Well, just as there's an imaginary kind of pole of this sphere, so too, 90 degrees down, all the way around, is an imaginary equator. I can call this the celestial equator, and I can make a little line for it through my graph. Okay? Good. Now, what does the sun do? Well, you watch the sun. You've probably noticed this, though you haven't known you've noticed it. On March 21st, actually probably March 20th, 21st, 22nd, 23rd, for about 4 days there, maybe eight, sort of depends on how you feel about it, the sun was rising in the east, dead east. I live on First Avenue, and it rose right down at the end of First Avenue, bomb, and it set right down at the other end of First Avenue. Dead east, dead west. Now, until the end of September, it's going to be rising from the east to the north of that. And it's going to get pretty way north. So from where I live, it's rising in the east up over Mount Seymour and setting down over Texada. And it's going to be very high at noon. And then at the end of September, it's going to be back down at the end of the streets. And then it's going to be going south and rising up over Mount Baker, setting over Bellingham, and barely getting above the horizon, if you can see it, right? And it's up for about 4 hours or something. Seems like it. Now, and so it goes, and it in fact seems to oscillate compared to my due east, due west, due north, due south, which I've set up according to my stars. So here's the sun. If I could take a Walt Disney stop photograph of this, I'll make an exposure every time it's on the horizon. It's rising in the east. It's going like that. And each of those times, it's a year. So here it's summer, winter, right? With spring and fall in between. You could get the same picture with the shadow of a stick at noon. Long, long shadow in the winter, short, short shadow in the summer, long, short, long, short, long, short, oscillating. All right, what's going on here? Well, all right, let's look at the stars every morning before sunrise. In fact, we could look at what the Egyptians called the heliacal rising. That is, what is the last bunch of stars you can see in the eastern sky at dawn before the sun gets so bright you don't see stars anymore? And you refer to the heliacal rising or something or other. That's the time of year it is now. What you'd see if you paid attention to what little star groups are there in the east before the sun's rising is that the little group that was just visible before, see, they're rising, right? A little group that rose and you saw very faintly and then it was blotted out by the solar glare a month before is now quite higher in the sky and has been visible and rose way before dawn. Now it's rising when it's still dark. And sometime later it'll be even higher in the sky when another bunch of stars is now rising at sunrise. What you notice, you can also notice, what is another way of saying the same thing, that the sun appears to be rising later than the stars each day. And it's not going clunk, clunk, clunk. It is slowly sliding back from west to east through the stars. And if I watch this a lot, I find out it slides all the way around. And that corresponds to this oscillation. So let's call it a year. In other words, it's with the same bunch of stars again when it's, say, rising maximally south in the east. There it is with, I forget what. So here's the path of the sun through the stars.
Yeah.
Each day, the sun and stars go all around pretty well together. It rises with a bunch of stars and sets pretty well with them and rises very near to them again and sets with them again. The sun goes around once a day. But it's rising a little later each day. So it's like slipping back slowly. So it has its own proper motion compared to the stars. And now we could do Walt Disney or planetarium tricks. Hold the stars still, or turn out the sun and make it real dim, like 50 watts. And then take a picture once every 24 hours by star time. So the stars keep on looking the same, then the sun's going to look like it's slipping back. But that's going to take a year. In fact, that's what you mean by a year, at least a solar year. Well, it's the only kind of year. Yeah, it's a solar year. All right? Now, stuff like this is true of the Moon, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, though they have their own little doodads. The Moon you can actually see. If you watch a full moon rise at sunset, and you're out in the woods enough that you can see some stars with it, though not near it. It's hard to see stars on a full moon, but you just, you know, use your, the width of your hand or something, or the length of your thumb or anything else, at arm's length. Measure in an east-west direction where the moon is compared to a particular star, and then do it again when the moon sets at sunrise. And you'll see the moon has slipped back about 15 or 16 times its width. I think that's about right. The moon is going to slip back all the way around once a month. So 30 days roughly to do 360 degrees, and the moon's a half a degree wide. So you can actually see the moon setting later than the stars it rose with. Now it does weird stuff. I mean, compared to this, it's compared to what the sun's doing, it wiggles around that.
Aristotle understand that, or?
Oh yeah. This is all well known by the time Aristotle's around. There's a very decent technical astronomy.
So can you do phases of the moon? Basically,
well, the phases of the moon are simple because the moon plainly shines by is reflecting light from the sun, and it's only full when the sun's opposite. The sun's slipping around once a year. The moon's going to do this once a month, so it's doing it 12 times. Well, so it's going to be opposite the sun roughly 12 times a year. And so you get the phases of the moon. The seasons have entirely to do with oblique rays are not as strong as direct rays, and it's just hotter when the sun is overhead more.
Can I just make a comment?
Sure.
You admit everything else moves, but what makes the Earth so special that it doesn't?
Oh, come on. No. Well, I'll tell you what. Let me ask you a question. What's happening now?
Earth moved up to
get
a chakra.
Oh, please.
I just had to say that.
What's happening now? Tell you what, it's time for our break. When you come back, you'll tell me what's happening. Okay. I have no problem with it.
They do move, that's right.
All right.
You have to measure.
This brain drain?
Yeah, we're plotting against you.
You're doing the brain, the drain? I'm not interested in brains. Okay.
You're on the chakra.
Yeah, look, what's this?
It's falling straight.
What's
down.
Happening?
It hit the ground.
Yes? Why? What's going on here? This I'm showing you how I know the Earth is at rest.
Because this happens.
It doesn't land over there.
Well, it's part of it.
It actually goes through the door.
Well, that's west, this is east.
But his door's going 700 miles an hour too, so.
But that's, but those of you that also entertain the idea we're going around the sun while we're spinning, add in another 1,000 miles an hour.
But if everything's going the same speed.
Everything's moving the same speed, so if you drop a bomb on, from under an airplane, it stays under the airplane all the way to the ground.
Another nice 12th century example.
Sure, all you have to do is go along in a cart, do the same thing while the cart's moving, it's still gonna get a spot on the cart below you.
Well, in the very.
You dropped it, it's not gonna drop over here, it's gonna drop there.
Do it in a car that's going 60 miles an hour with a convertible.
Well, you don't have to go that, let's keep the air going the same speed too, having it close well.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
Well, it's gotta, I mean, we gotta start getting some speed up, and you gotta drop it far enough to notice. I mean, either drop it very far or go very fast.
Find a big hill and put some wheels on something and.
Well, most of my terrestrial experience, pre-jet plane and combustion engine and so on, is that if I let something go, it lands behind me. Isn't that what happens to you? You ever drop something off your bicycle?
No, but drop it onto the floor of the cart.
Well,
everything's moving along, right?
Well, if you drop it off your bicycle, it hits right beside you.
Not in my experience.
You quickly leave it behind, but it lands right beside you. If you drop it vertically.
And there's no air.
No, where did you drop it?
I dropped it down on a BC ferry. And you keep standing in one place. But you know the ship is.
Well, it's moving pretty slow. I don't spend that much time in the air. Besides, we're talking about, I mean, look, that might get relevant if I didn't already have a whole bunch of other things I know about this. See, I bet you guys who think the Earth moves probably can't explain it.
Well,
what the hell's going on? What's going on here? What's going on here?
Isn't
we all know it's falling. I mean, there's no problem.
Forces at right angles to each other have no effect on one another. In other words,
is that a slogan of some kind?
The fact that the compression moving that direction at 700 miles per hour,
yes,
has absolutely no effect on its motion in the vertical.
Well, says you. I mean,
you haven't proved it yet.
You've just announced that.
That's why it goes straight.
Let's forget the spinning for a minute. What's happening?
There's attraction between the chalk brush and the floor.
Oh, yeah?
Well, something's obviously pulling the two together.
That's obvious?
Well, they're touching when you let go. You're using some force to hold the brush up. As soon as you remove that force, the two objects have come to touch and at rest.
And you say this makes it so obviously it's being pulled.
I didn't say obviously it's being pulled. I'm saying something is causing.
Did he say obviously it's being pulled?
Yes, he did. Okay, I'll take back the obviously.
what you're arguing, I presume, is that the Earth is at the center. It's just falling down to the center.
All right. Is this is made out of the same stuff the Earth is.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
More or less.
Yeah. We'll give you that.
This kind of stuff. That's a poetic way of putting it. I say this thing is moving itself.
What do you mean it doesn't move itself after it hits the ground?
It can't go through the floor. You make a hole there, it'll go lower.
Why doesn't it bounce back up again?
Oh, that's got to do with what it's made out of. It's bouncing a little. It's rubbery.
Well, why doesn't it keep moving? Do things always move down?
It is moving itself, okay? And although this is an instance of what I call local motion, namely change in place, because the word for place is locus, so it's place moving from one place to another, the most boring kind of motion, just being here, and then being there, and then being there. This is an example of local motion, but it's much more interesting, and so you could say this is moving, and I say it's moving itself, but it's much more interesting to realize that, are you getting tired of this?
Yeah.
Stop it!
Please
laugh.
long as you don't keep bending the...
What causes the motion?
I'll tell you in a minute. What's much more interesting is to realize that this is an example, this self-moving local motion, of a much more general process called growth. This thing...
So if we leave that alone for a while, it'll get bigger?
No, it'll get heavier.
Oh, it'll get heavier.
Yep. You are watching it grow heavier. That's what you're seeing. You are seeing a heavy thing grow heavier.
Can you prove that it goes faster as it goes lower?
It might go faster as it goes farther. That's a research problem.
No, it's easy enough.
But it's growing heavier.
What's causing it to grow heavier?
Its own being.
One of those beings has that thing of realized, unrealized.
That's right. This is a heavy thing. With respect to this business as a heavy thing, it's also a chalk brush, And with respect to leaping off buildings and whatnot, I too am a heavy thing. But I'm more than that, so are you. But as a heavy thing, just qua its existence as a heavy thing, it is informed by an immaterial form, an immaterial thing, which you've got to call it something, so we'll call it heaviness. It's the noun version of heavy. This thing is moving itself in order to become more perfectly what it is, in order to actualize its potential as a heavy thing.
So it gets heavier as it falls.
That's right.
What if you started with something that was heavier? Would it fall faster?
It's a good question. I think, now I'm being a bit Aristotelian, the only research I know about into this is research in mechanics and things like seesaws, levers, beam balances, and so on. I'm the author of a treatise. There's a treatise on mechanics attributed to me. I feel like I'm on Steve Allen or something. It's really by an Aristotelian whose name is not known. And in these circumstances, I discovered that the speed of a thing seems to vary proportionally as its weight and inversely proportionally as the resistance to its motion. And given two things falling in air, then if this is right, then the heavier thing should have a higher speed. Oh, you'll see about that in 1590, Galileo does that. Yep. But now I'm going to step into my role. Now Straker speaking. Yes, every commentator will tell you, according to the Aristotelians, heavier things fall faster. And there is one place in De Chilo, I think, on the heavens, where Aristotle says heavier things fall faster. I think, but I haven't had the time to publish this as a finding, I think that research would show, I don't think this is something that's manageable as a term paper, I think research would show that Aristotle and the Aristotelians who say that are talking about, are laying out something that they know is true in statics, beam balances, levers, situations where things are being moved in constraint. And generalizing it to the whole world of moving things. One of the things that happens at the end of the Middle Ages is the, quote, discovery that things that are falling are not in a situation adequately described by mechanics. And so this doesn't work. So the situation now, getting back into my role, the research that has been done on this suggests that the speed at which these heavy things fall is indeed proportional to their weight, but frankly, I've never looked at it, so I don't know. I the few little incidences I can recall, I think the heavier thing lands first. But I'm not usually dropping stuff and watching it. It's usually an accident if I drop something.
Even if we prove to you that that actual mass has no difference from that, say we prove it to you, the mass has no difference from speed.
Yeah.
Couldn't you still explain, wouldn't your theory still hold up?
I think it probably would. Yeah, I think it probably would. What I could end up deciding, I mean, I can see where you're going. What I could end up deciding is that the motive power this thing has in it has to move something more massive. And so this always just balances out. The more heavy a thing is, the more motive power it's got, but it's also got more heaviness to actualize, so light things and heavy things will fall together. That might make sense. But this looks to me like a research problem. Let's find out. Maybe we, as with most things, we won't find out until it matters, unless somebody gets the time to just look at it for its own sake. But then it'll have to matter for some conceptual reason. But maybe this would be worth finding out someday. But anyway, look, here's this heavy thing. It is growing more heavy, says I. And in this case, which as I'm going to remind you again and again, is the most boring kind of growing, the most boring kind of motion, though the most easy to see. Well, it's not even the most easy to see. It's real dull. I mean, this is stupider than the dumbest fungus. Okay? I mean, this is really dumb. All this thing knows how to do is get closer to a place, an absolute place, where if it could get there, it would be perfectly heavy. And if it got there, it would rest. Because to move anywhere from there would be to become less perfect than it is. Move away from actualizing its capacity in having reached that place where it is most perfectly what it is, has realized its capacity most fully, it rests. It stops moving itself. From this, it follows that the Earth is at rest and is spherical. Because all of this heavy stuff is globed in a sphere, of course, around that place where, if a heavy thing were there, it would be perfectly heavy. And everything has got as close to that place as it can. So the Earth is a sphere, and it's resting. And I see that confirmed every time I let go of a heavy thing. Oh, well, now we're into... Yeah, that's chemistry.
No, what about fire?
That's chemistry.
What about fire, though? He mentions here the idea of a perfectly light object that continually rises.
Ah, yes.
What if we disproved that particles from fire continually rise? I mean, what if we carefully observed some piece of smoke and we saw it come back to Earth?
Okay, research problem. It might be that there is no such thing as a thing that's absolutely potentially light. Yes, the flip side of this story is the flame, the fire, it is actualizing its capacity by moving away from the center of the Earth. That might not be right. It might be that there are only more or less heavy things.
So you'll throw that out and still...
I think I can live with that. I haven't been convinced yet. You're only mentioning it for the first time.
Right.
It's a research problem. There might be just varying degrees of heavy things. In other words, fire might be in the air like a cork in the water. I let go of it.
That's what I would try to prove.
Well, okay, but that's fine. I'm still an Aristotelian. Heavy things.
Let's get back to the objects.
Hold it. Let me make sure. Larry, you have something?
The Earth has reached its potential heaviness.
That little bit of heavy stuff right in the center of the Earth is perfectly heavy. It has actualized its heaviness. All the rest of it isn't there yet. I mean, we're along, you know, all this stuff is, what's the radius of the Earth? 3,000 miles?
Radius?
Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit.
3,000 miles. This thing is 3,000 miles away from being as heavy as it can get, and it's trying. Well, now it ran into the floor. If you get the floor out of the way, it'll keep trying. I mean, it's still trying. It's pushing on the floor even.
Is there a constant change in the heaviness in terms of the distance?
I would guess so, yeah.
So if you found that the highest place on Earth and dropped that,
yeah,
and measured the weight of it at the top of the highest place and then at the lowest, and
its heaviness. Oh, I see what you're saying. Is it heavier? Does it feel heavier?
Right.
Yeah. I don't know what mass is. I have to tell you what that is. But does it feel heavier here than on top of some mountain?
Yeah.
Interesting question. I think it might. I think it might feel heavier here.
But there's a scale.
Yeah, we can
bring a scale. We'll weigh you here, and we'll take you down. We'll take you down on the ground. We'll weigh you there.
I think it might, but I don't know if I got to be committed to that.
Well, you would have to minimum that you're interested in, but you could also, if you had a large enough distance on Earth, and I think we could get something like that. You can have a comparison between the distance that you're traveling here, dropping it from your hand to the floor, and the distance it is from here to the center of the Earth.
Yeah. And what?
Well, if there's no change in heaviness, you're saying that the change is consistent or constant.
I should think it would be if there is such a change. My initial hunch is to say the heaviness of the thing.
It wouldn't have to be. Even though you measure 1,000 feet of height and a small change in mass, who says the next 1,000 feet will be?
I'm sorry, I meant continuous, not constant.
Yeah, so
I assume it's continuous. But I'm not even sure. I guess it probably would have to be right that it gets measurably heavier. I'm thinking. I'm not sure.
Where's the state map?
If you measure it,
you can get tables.
I've been doing all this talking about actualizing heaviness. I guess it would follow that it ought to feel heavier the closer it gets to the center of the world. And if you're saying, gee, it really does, then hooray for me. Yeah. Yes, sir?
Ha!
I was just going to ask you that. Does anybody know?
No.
Huh? No?
Is that perfect?
Well, they're perfect. They're no.
Not
no.
No. They're not at rest.
They're not at rest. They're perfectly light and they'd be moving away.
Right?
No, but they have to be lighter than, say, that chalk brush.
No.
They're away from that perfect heaviness.
If the moon were made out of that stuff, it would have landed down here long ago. Right? It's made out of different stuff. It's stuff that's neither heavy nor light. In fact, it's not terrestrial stuff at all. That's right. It moves itself differently because it's different stuff.
It's realized as...
Well, the celestial stuff, which there's four, some people call them elements, I'd rather call them principles. There's four terrestrial, I'll call them principles. Underneath this are four elementary qualities. This is all terrestrial. And since the moon doesn't fall, or the stars, or Mars, or Jupiter, or the sun, or since none of that stuff moves towards the center of the world, it's obviously not this stuff. So it's a fifth principle element or something, hence being very literal-minded. we call it the fifth essence.
Greek essence.
Yeah, it's the fifth.
Sounds like a fruit.
The fifth essence. Oh, yeah, I know.
That's history.
Really?
It's the celestial, unchanging, perfect, already realized, wonderful stuff. Here's the four terrestrial ones, and here's the fifth, the quintessence. One, two, three, four essences, and five essences. Yes, sir? Okay, well, that's chemistry again. I don't particularly want to stick to. I don't mind sticking to earth things.
Clouds are water, and that's an earth thing.
Clouds, the whole rain business. I'll explain this in a minute if you want. But the whole rain business, I mean, all this stuff. This is the continual transformation of air into water, into air, into water, into air, into water. That's what it is. It's basically the exchange of hotness and coldness. From hot and wet to dry and wet. Or,
yeah,
sorry,
it's
from hot
and... that, isn't it? You admit that...